grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 303, the first official show of 2021, and, well, there's really only one thing that can be said about that.
Merry New Year!
That's right, everybody. Happy New Year! It is that time of year. It is that time of year to focus yourself on new things, to really kind of hone in on, I guess, what it is that you're doing for the next year. I always kind of try to make myself, it's not necessarily a resolution, but a betterment promise for myself. I find the resolution kind of like a Lenten promise. It's really easy to back out of, but if I make myself kind of a challenge, like this last year, which became a challenge rapidly because of COVID this last year, my challenge to myself was whenever I came off the road, that I didn't rearrange cabinets and things like that, that I remembered the fact that this was my wife's world here at the house and that I was just living in it. And had it not been for sticking to my guns and keeping that going, man, it would have been a whole lot more rough of a ride. I tell you that right now. So hopefully our families have been able to get together over the holidays. We've been able to spend that kind of important time with each other. All this healing time that we have to have as people all over the world. And tonight, our guest, speaking of all over the world, is across the world in the UK. We have Charles Christian, author of Yorkshire's Weird Wolds, Inside the Wald-Newton Triangle. We will be talking about all kinds of fun stuff, ley lines. Charles Christian is also a writer for Ancient Origins. He is the host, or one of the hosts, of Weird Tales. We will be getting into all kinds of fun stuff, including a little bit of Christmas lore, things like that. He writes a lot about ancient lores, different histories. I think he's got a new book coming out about witches, all kinds of fun stuff. We'll be getting into great conversation. Please do remember that our show today is brought to you by Podcast Cadet. If you're a fan of podcasting like I am, want to start up a podcast for your friends, family, church, school, business, fun, whatever, stop on by podcastcadet.com today. They are the place for you. A to Z, soup to nuts. All they do is podcasting, whether it is workshops, one-on-one trainings, consultations. If you are having tech issues in your studio and just need somebody to knock that around with, they have one-on-one time with professional AV technicians to be able to help you out. They have tons of classes like their podcast boot camp, Podcast 101, preserving audio quality, how to spark your creativity, even improv for hosts. Teaching you to be more of an extemporaneous speaker, thinking on your feet, maybe improving your wit a little bit. If it's hard for you to be off script, that's the kind of stuff they do. So stop on by today. Podcastcadet.com is the website. Dudes20 is the code that you want to use to save 20% on your cart on the way out the door. Thank you so much, Podcast Cadet, for being a sponsor of the show. Our guest today, I'm so excited to talk to him. Welcome to the show, Charles Christian. How are you, sir?
I am fine. Good to speak to you.
Absolutely. I am so excited to talk with you today. We've had so many topics here lately that have been things that I have wanted to talk about on this show. And it's just become the fact that I will not bring guests on the show. I won't have a conversation on the show without a guest that can talk about it in a voice of authority. So you yourself are somebody who's written about these topics, taken these topics to heart, discussed these topics like ley lines, ancient folklore, things like that for years. Give our audience, I guess, a little primer into what brought you into this field to begin with, and what brought you to working now with one of the great publications out there in the field of disclosure and forbidden knowledge, hidden knowledge, knowledge of the cabal, things like that. Ancient Origins. I love the fact that you are writing for them, because I followed their work for years.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things. I grew up in at a time where, I suppose, just harking back to Christmas that's just gone by, to a time when, in the UK we're talking about, we didn't have television dominating the Christmas air time. Which still was family parties and sitting around a fire at night with the lights off and just candles burning and people telling ghost stories. And I lived in a spooky old house, and there were odd, strange features of the property down below. It was a part of the house is medieval, and you could see where the walls were 3 or 4 feet thick in places, and there were strange cellars that led nowhere and tunnels and things. And, you know, picking up from my grandmother, who is then taking us back into the 19th century with her time and her parents' tales, you know, stories about smugglers and things of that nature. So I was sort of surrounded by it all, and I was always interested in ghost stories and the supernatural. And then when I was at university, I used to go ghost hunting, very, very primitive by modern standards, just basically flask of hot coffee and sitting around in a graveyard or a reputedly haunted place with a notebook waiting to see something.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, old, very, very much old school. But then unfortunately, I had to make a living. And so such things got rather put aside. And for a long time, I was a legal journalist and then a technology journalist. And it's only recently I've been able to get back into the groove and start pursuing this as my main interest. So I'm now writing books about it. As you mentioned, I do the Weird Tales radio show. And the other aspect is history. I've always been intrigued in history. Again, back from my upbringing, it was a seaport town called Scarborough. Still is a seaport town called Scarborough, on the east coast of England. And there's a huge headland in the middle of it. And on that headland, there are the remains of a Roman Empire's signal station. And that, in turn, has subsequently been built around by a medieval castle that's still there with the walls all around it. So it dominates the town. And so, I say again, I had a huge interest in history from an early age, and that's how I got involved with Ancient Origins. I pitched them some history ideas, and we went on from there. And I say I've been writing for them now pretty much regularly for about 6 years or so.
Oh, wow. Wow. What an incredible opportunity to... And like I said, they are one of the publications that is out there that I've followed for a long time because they're on my RSS feed, on my RSS reader. Like, I see stuff from Ancient Origins daily. So how I have not run across your work prior to this, Charles, I don't know how you slipped past my radar, my man.
I think one of the things is they do put a lot of stuff out.
They do. And they are prolific.
My stuff tends to be on the Ancient Origins premium site, which is behind the paywall. So it may well be that. But I had an article up there beginning of December. Well, yes, only 8 days ago, on talking about medieval zombies. They called them revenants in those days, but it was looking at the fact that so many people in those days treated it almost as, well, of course, there are these shambling zombies wandering around the place. Everybody knows that. And so it was just looking as to where these tales came from. And again, going back to my upbringing, where I grew up, there's a deserted medieval village called Warham Percy. And it's been known for a long time because the church is still there, and you can still, part of the church is still there, and you can see the undulations in the landscape where cottages and buildings were. But they were excavating the graveyard relatively recently, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years. And they discovered that about a dozen of the bodies in the graveyard had been ritually mutilated. They'd had their limbs broken and their heads removed and their heads placed between their limbs. And this was a way people in those days thought, this is how you stop the dead from walking. You break the legs so they can't walk. You cut the heads off so they can't see where they're going.
Yeah.
This, you know, there was a whole raft of them there. So I found that very intriguing that so close to where I grew up, there was this element of belief in the revenants. And I say it was a big thing for them. I mean, it's a bit complicated because it also ties in, because you're remembering in those days, there was only in Europe, there was only the Christian religion, the Catholic religion. And it was very much a belief that you needed a good death. And if you didn't have a good death and you weren't sort of seen by a priest before you died, then you wouldn't go to heaven and you'd possibly wander the earth or go down to hell. So it was a big thing there.
Well, and granted, even there in the UK, there is quite the tradition, of course, of Druidism, things like that, necromancy, all kinds of stuff. So like you said, for this to be a commonplace practice to mutilate the dead to prevent them from rising is not a strange thing to see. It's not something, it's kind of like going to Eastern Bloc Europe and seeing the same kind of thing where they had raging belief in vampirism.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's intriguing that some of the early accounts of the revenants, as say they call them, they do seem to have sometimes vampire-like characteristics.
Hmm.
I mean, part of it, I think, is, again, you're dealing with medieval understanding of human anatomy and the decomposition problem. And how bodies actually rot, and the fact that they can look flushed, and the fact that they can be bloodied sometimes, and they will bloat, and if they're very poorly buried, they will actually almost make their way back up to the surface again. Because, of course, in those days, only the very rich were buried in coffins. Everybody else was just in a bag in the ground.
Yeah, you were just wrapped in linen and tossed in the ground.
Yeah, so there was, you can see where, I mean, that's one of the things that always intrigues me about folklore and legends, the fact you can often see that there is a factual basis for a belief. There was something actually going on there. And it's just purely that the people of that era didn't know enough about science
and
biology, and so they misinterpreted it. And obviously, education was virtually non-existent for most people. And so if a body that had been buried suddenly appears on the surface again and is all bloated and covered in blood, well, they think it's come back from the dead and wandered around sucking people's blood. You know, so you get these beliefs. So suddenly bingo, there you've got the basis of the vampire. And you know, say it's so many of these beliefs. There is actually a nugget of truth lying at the root of it.
Sure.
It's just that you have to look at it with the eyes of someone of 800, 900 years ago, and then it makes sense. But if you look at it in the modern light, you think, you know, silly people.
Well, and the sincerity to which it was believed by people centuries ago. I mean, to so much to the point that there were texts written on how to hunt vampires, on how mm-hmm. to stop them. There was equipment sold. There were vampire kits that you could go out and buy. Kind of like if you look at the old Sears Roebuck ads, how they had like a heroin kit, you know, where it was like, here's your glass syringe, shoot on up. It's like, oh, so you're an average dude. Don't worry about it. Go out and hunt some vampires. You're all good.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
But it's interesting to go through and look, like you're saying, to look at these little macrocosms of history.
Mm.
And to see how these threads carry through, because even our conversation prior to this show, and even in the intro to the show where I said that we'd be getting into a little bit of Christmas lore, things like that, to go through and look at our traditions of Christmas that we hold across the world.
Yes.
And the way that they're tied together, the way that and of course, the American concept of Santa Claus, things like that, was like utterly usurped from European tradition and twisted and screwballed by Coca-Cola.
The poem, isn't it, The Night Before Christmas, that sets the little the Santa Claus model. That
yeah, it really have. Sets up the mythos.
Except, of course, in the that poem, Santa Claus was actually more of an elf in size rather than the larger guy. But mm-hmm. again, that's a fascinating one where you've got this mixture, because you've got Santa Claus, then you've got Father Christmas, which sort of goes back to slightly more druidy type of beliefs. And if you look all across Europe, they have a winter type person. I think it's called Father Frost in Russia, I think. But similar type of beliefs, similar type of elements. And then you've got St. Nicholas, who's also in there giving his side of things. And I say in the more Catholic countries in Europe, the St. Nicholas side of things tends to be played up more. And others, it's Father Christmas, and in others it's Santa Claus. But it's all they're all in there, all these different roots. And then scratching again, then you're down to, well,
yeah,
you know, is Odin in there, because he, you know, traveled the winter skies. And
they aren't too far off whenever you start going into the history of where the Yule tree came from. Mm-hmm. where the history of decorating Yule trees came from, which was pretty much putting up the fruits of your first harvest on your local tree to say thank you, Gaia. The harvest season is about to end. Here's some fruits, some vegetables. Oh, and some animal parts for all the great hunting this season. Like tinsel was literally entrails originally. So once you start seeing that and seeing the adoption and seeing the way that these literal traditions that were happening locally in Germanic countries, in Druidic countries, get rolled into what we have. And even now, like we were saying earlier, with the rise of things like Krampus, really the re-rise, because at one point the traditions of Krampus, especially in Eastern Europe, were rampantly popular.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they were right up until the early 1930s, but yeah. It was actually it was the Nazis in Germany and in Austria who tended to squash it, because totalitarian states don't like people having fun, and the Krampus was a bit too anarchic for them.
Not unless it's their fun.
Oh, well, exactly, yes. Organized funny, yeah.
Yeah.
He got squashed, and I mean, he almost died out, but has made a comeback. And I say he's making a comeback in parts of the world that never formerly had it. I think it's that intriguing thing about the contrast between your St. Nicholas character, your Santa Claus, who gives presents to the good children, and the Krampus, or Santa's dark helper.
Yeah.
And there's a whole raft of them across Europe.
Yeah, like Black Peter, all kinds of stuff, where it's where the whole concept of switches and coal come from. And of course, Krampus would just take you in his sack and torture your soul with chains. Beat you with chains in a sack if you weren't a good kid.
Take you away. I mean, yes. it's a lovely idea that Santa and Krampus turn up at the house, and one's got a sack full of presents, and the other one's got a sack to take the children away if they've been naughty.
Yeah, exactly. But, they both got sacks. They're just used for different. The one's coming, one's going.
Yeah, but it makes a nice balance, and
one of the things I was bringing up before the show as we had this conversation was the documentary Wrinkles the Clown, and I watched it not too long ago, and I was like, my Lord, this is a great documentary. And I remember seeing the stories about Wrinkles the Clown in the news. He was a clown in Florida that would just appear on the side of the road with balloons. And I don't know if you can see the video here, but his face is extraordinarily saggy. It's a really creepy looking clown. And he would just stand on the side of the road and wave.
Yes.
And then phone numbers started popping up for Wrinkles the Clown. Have kids that are misbehaving, call Wrinkles. And it became like this threat by parents of like, if you don't behave, I'll call Wrinkles and stuff. And they showed kids that were like freaking out, man, whenever their parents were like, I'll call Wrinkles, and they call it up and no. And I won't even give it away, because there's such a twist in the actual story of Wrinkles the Clown that it's like, wow. And as somebody that's into folklore, my friend, because this is one that right up there with Slenderman, things like that, is in the world of modern folklore. And it's phenomenal to see the flip that happens in this documentary, because I was even surprised, and I'm normally the one that's like, okay, I can see where this is going to go. But man, it was just so interesting to see the parallels there was a really interesting study done recently about how things like that are necessary for children.
I mean, I don't know if you had that growing up, but you were told things. There's a whole they call them in folklore sort of nursery warnings, or cautionary nursery tales. You know, if you aren't good, something will come and get you. If you aren't good, the bogeyman who lives under your bed will get you. If you aren't good, the bogeyman who lives in the cupboard under the stairs will get you. And those are all really very creepy things. And, you know, I grew up in a house that had a very creepy cupboard under the stairs.
Yeah. When you have, like, little secret things and stuff like that.
Yeah. But, you know, it's that spooky thing. And, you know, there's a creature called Jenny Green, who lives in the water. And she was used as, if you're not behaving, it was sort of when you're taking kids out in a park or somewhere and there's a boating lake or an ornamental lake. And, you know, you'd say, if you're not good, Jenny Greenteeth will come out of that water and drag you away and drown you. Yeah. And it's a whole, again, really scary. The kind of scary that if you did it today, you know, you'd have social services and the police intervening. You know, you're terrifying your children.
Yeah.
But it was all accepted as what you do it. But
yeah. And that's just it. It's what you did as a Cajun. My family told stories about the tatai, stuff like that. It was just the Cajun word for boogeyman, basically. And that's what you're be good or the tatai will come get you, you know, stuff like that. Very much the same thing. And I think every culture kind of has that concept. And to see that carried forward, to see that even now, like you're saying, like we were just saying, there are studies being done on the effect it has on children. And is it a good effect? Is it a healthy effect? You know, kind of like the whole concept of, I don't know if you have it over there, Charles, but the snipe hunt. It's kind of a rite of passage as a Southern kid, to take people snipe hunt.
Oh, right.
You know, and the funny thing is, snipe exist. They're small, flightless, coastland birds, but you're not going to find them out in the middle of the woods.
Yeah.
In Texas or in Louisiana, you know, like 100 miles inland. But there's this rite of passage to it that, like, you got taken, you know, you got taken on the ride. And it's interesting because, now our society, of course, with hazing and stuff like that, it's become very, very different.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's it. It's one thing if your parents or your grandparents give you this warning about the bogeyman that's lurking under your bed. It's different when it sort of becomes more organized bullying and deliberately terrifying people. But it's like most things. It's all down to a matter of degree, a matter of scale, and you know.
Well,
a little is all right, but excess, then you've got to draw a line.
Well, and that's just it. And I think that tale of caution really came to bear up around 2012 when the two girls dragged their friend off into the woods to sacrifice her to Slenderman.
Yes.
You know, where it was like, urban legend gone horribly awry.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, Slender Man actually started as a competition, didn't it, on Creepypasta or something to devise the scariest monster you could think of.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure on the timings, but of course there were some creatures a bit like that in one of the episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm. They were quiet and they wore suits and they sort of lurched along. They were very scary. You know, it's that losing the track between fiction and fact. And I say again, that's one of the intriguing things about folklore, because you can see where a story begins. For example, a lot of what we now regard as vampire lore actually starts in Bram Stoker's novel Dracula, some of the aspects of it. And likewise with werewolves. If you look at the 1930s movies, The Werewolf of London and whatever the sequel was, they have set the template that now people think is the real thing, that you shoot a werewolf with a silver bullet and that the werewolf, when it dies, returns to the human form. That's purely from the
That is totally Hollywood. There is not a bit about Silver working on werewolves anywhere in folklore.
No.
Nowhere.
No. No.
Vampires, yes.
Yeah.
Because it's the metal of the moon, and that's, of course, part of where it comes in with werewolves, is it's always been the metal ascribed to the moon.
Exactly,
but
yes.
Aside from that, nowhere in folklore is it like, hey, shoot him with a silver bullet, because the concept of werewolves and lycanthropy goes back to ancient Rome.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, silver bullets didn't exist, man.
Yes, it's a wonder we didn't all become extinct.
Yeah, yeah.
We can't kill them. We've got to wait 2,000 years till somebody invents a gun.
We'd all be lycanthropes. It'd be one big party on full moon, you know?
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the Germans in the late Middle Ages, early modern period, they had a thing about werewolves and believed they existed. But when you look at their woodcuts in manuscripts and things, they just treated them as being an extra fierce wolf, and you attacked it the same way you deal with any fierce animal, with bows and arrows and spears and axes. And there's even one picture I've seen where the werewolf's been hung on a gallows. So, you know, it's one of those things. Where did this story come from? And but say there is an interesting thing you get in dealing with witchcraft, and there was a belief that witches could turn into hares, jackrabbits, if you like, and go about their business. And it was believed if you shot a hare with a silver bullet, and we're talking in the days then of muzzle loading muskets and things, so he didn't even need a silver bullet. He just could wedge down a silver coin or a silver button or
just
something
like
that. Just go
grape shot on it.
Anything, exactly. And if you shot them, and then the next day the person you thought was a witch would be injured in the leg or the part of the body where you shot the hare with. But I mean, so there was this sort of slightly older tradition of dealing with witches with silver bullets, but as for werewolves, strictly 1930s that story came along.
Yeah, and it's interesting even just to see the way that cultures and stories cross. Because even here in America, with the Native Americans, there are stories of lycanthrope type creatures, the skinwalker, things like that, you know. To see the fact that some of these themes are carried across cultures across the globe, it's really fascinating.
It is. And I mean, I think one of the possible sources is when you go back, this is back to the European thing, but the Vikings, who everybody is now familiar with thanks to the streaming series, there were berserkers who wore bear skins, and basically they were, I suppose you'd say, high on drugs and alcohol.
They ate fly agaric, man.
Exactly. And they would psych themselves up and think they were embodied with the spirit of a bear and go into battle, and they'd be unstoppable. And a lot of them didn't even wear armor. They'd just go thrashing in there and terrify everybody. But as well as the berserkers, there were also ones, and it's an unpronounceable Scandinavian name, the Wolfhers, and they believed in they were in the embodiment of a wolf, and they would wear a wolf pelt and the wolf head over themselves, and exactly the same characteristics. And so, you know, is there a trait in European folklore of the werewolf? Because people once upon a time did encounter very ferocious half-human, half-wolf-like creatures that appeared up unstoppable and were out on a killing spree. And
or could it be even that some of those early people, especially when you're talking the 12, 1300s, something along those lines, may have actively run across something along the likes of a dire wolf, which may very well have still been a holdover from the Ice Age in those upper northern parts.
Yep. That's still a possibility, that. And, that all the big creatures from there could well have lived on. I mean,
sure.
In Russia, they're pushing forward the dates when they think the last mammoths became extinct. They certainly overlapped with early man, and there are suggestions they may, in some of the remote islands and parts, have survived much longer, and again into times when what we'd now class as modern man was around that area, and would have memories of them, or nothing else, would have found their frozen bodies. And you'd think, again, not knowing, as they would of those days, the benefits of refrigeration, they wouldn't be able to tell whether that frozen mammoth they've just stumbled across was 10 years old or 10,000 years old.
Yeah.
So again, it's all these overlaps that, it comes back to the point I was making, that behind the most bizarre myths, there is usually an element of truth. It's just not necessarily the truth that you think it is. You may have to do a bit of lateral thinking to work it out.
Well, and that's a great way to put it, the lateral thinking, the fact that you really have to kind of shift your paradigm and the way that you're filtering and processing information, and be willing to do so. Really be willing to look at things with new eyes, look at them from a new direction. I mean, one of the things that we bring up on this show all the time, Charles, is you want to talk conspiracy theory, man. It's only been about 500 years that we all agreed that the world was round.
Yeah.
Up until then, like, we straight up put people to the stake and lit them on fire because they taught that the world was round.
Oh, yeah.
Or that or that the sun was the center of the solar system.
Mm.
You know? I mean, heck, we only unexcommunicated Galileo like a decade ago.
Yeah.
It was only a decade ago that the church was like, yeah, man, our bad.
Yeah.
Seriously, we've had a lot of things going on. Just saw this was still on the books. Sorry about that. How does that even happen?
Yeah.
But it's one of those, until people were open-minded enough to sit down and have the conversation, to sit down and look at the evidence provided from a different point of view.
Yes. Yeah. And, you're talking about Galileo and the church. Back in those times, the church effectively had the monopoly on literacy.
Yeah.
And education and publishing. It was relatively recent, later, that printing presses came along. They were handwritten manuscripts produced by the church and carrying the church's party line. And
absolutely. A prime example, even looking into some of the stuff that you're researching presently for your upcoming book, look at the vengeance wrought through the Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of Witches, the book that really laid down, like, okay, here's how it, because I've got, let me see, where is it?
I've always got it nearby.
I've got my Roman ritual right here, that actively in the back, this is an old school one that has Latin on one side, English on the other. But in the back, it actively goes through and tells you, like, hey, here's how you identify a possessed person.
Yeah.
Like, here are the signs that you need to notice if you're going to be an exorcist. So the Malleus Maleficarum was very much the same way, where it was like, here are the signs to identify a warlock, to identify a witch, to identify a sorcerer, to identify a necromancer, who was specifically somebody who dealt in sorcery, talking with and communing with the dead.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And because it came from the church, people accepted it. You know, it must be true. You know, it's like we used to say once upon a time, it must be true. I've seen it on the, read it in the newspaper.
Yeah, yeah, I saw it on ABC.
Yeah, but, you know, they wouldn't lie. They wouldn't exaggerate.
Yeah, they wouldn't do that just to sell more copies, would they? And of course we know, yeah, they would. An inflammatory text will always do that. And right on the heels of Malleus Maleficarum and everything else is what led to the persecution of the Jews in Spain. It's what led to the Spanish Inquisition. It is what led to the persecution of the Jews in France, which is what got the Knights Templar in trouble with the king over there. Like it rained so much down when it came out, like just the release of that one text and the aftermath that it had on Europe as a whole is phenomenal.
Yes,
it is literally on the level of biblical proportions. It I would say easily had the same impact on Europe as the invention of the printing press and the release of Luther's version of the Bible.
Yes, the Reformation, Protestant Reformation. Yeah, no, I mean, it was a huge thing. And interestingly, the Protestants, the Puritans in particular, and you had that in Salem, the same thing. They were equally obsessed with witches and the belief that they were there, that they were in league with the devil, and had to be rooted out and killed. I mean, there is a suggestion that the bit everybody talks about in the Bible that says you shall not tolerate a witch to live is actually a mistranslation from the original Aramaic to the Greek to the Latin and backwards and forwards. And it actually talks about people who are using magic to cause harm.
That's right.
And for a long time, that was the official view, that if you were a witch and you were trying to cure people's warts or find their lost sheep, well, that was fine. But if you were using magic to cause harm, then that was different.
Yeah.
But I say when Malleus came out, it completely changed it. And it was basically any practice of witchcraft, no matter what the motives behind it, whether it's what we nowadays call white magic as opposed to black magic. You were for the chop.
Yeah, absolutely. And even when it came to practitioners of herbalized medicine, apothecaries, and at the time, really, I guess, alchemists, you know, people that were looking for. And I've gotten like it's become kind of a side obsession of mine, Christian, over COVID, reading alchemical texts. Like, I love reading philosophy, because to me, reading an instruction manual makes more sense than reading a novel. So for me, philosophy is like, oh, yeah, this is just like a really big instruction manual. OK, just no diagrams. And alchemical texts are just so fascinating to me. And to go into that little bit of lost arcane history and see the attempts that people were making chemically in secret, the way that they passed it along to people, the way that there were alchemists that were like famed across Europe and used by high courts and things like that to come up with their tinctures and medicines. And it's just fascinating to me. And along those same lines were people known as water witches, people that were known to be able to read the energy of the earth, to find water, to divine where water. And this is going into a modern practice. You can still go out to this day. There are numerous services in Texas where people will come out with their divining rods, find a spot within like 5 feet for you to drill for water on your property, you know. And that's what kind of brings us from this world of the arcane and the world of practicing magic into the world of ley lines and into the world of modern witchcraft like that, where it really is coming to bear that, I mean, even right now, I just posted an article to our Dudes and Beer group on Facebook all of a couple weeks ago before Christmas, where it's they've discovered a gravitational superhighway within the solar system where we can travel interplanetarily twice as fast almost. And there it is, you know, like we are finding through means of physics that things like ley lines, gravitational fields, magnetic fields, all these things match up. The temples built by various cultures lie along the same grid lines on the earth, kind of thing. So let's kind of pivot real quick and start getting into that world and the world of water witching, finding ley lines, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's one angle that says ley lines are just purely coincidence. And certainly there's a view that because we've got so many historical monuments and sites in the UK, for example, that you can't help but find several that are in a row. And they mean something. And I think there's another one I've seen, a comedy one on cropping up on Facebook, where somebody's drawn connections between, I think, a chain of diners in the US, and the way they've drawn it, it creates a pentacle, you know, a five-pointed star in it. So there is that sort of, you know, jokey element of it.
Sounds like a great QAnon thread right there.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know, you look at other ones, and I'm finishing a book at the moment on the folklore of the part of the world I now live in East Anglia. That's the bit that sticks out on the east of England. And there is a ley line that runs through there. It's the St. Michael, St. Mary line. There's two lines sort of very much following the same path, and there is a huge preponderance of churches dedicated to either the Virgin Mary or St. Michael, and it runs all the way from the coast right away across England, across through lots of ancient sites, including Stonehenge, and all the way to Land's End and on into the sea there. And it just seems such a coincidence that all of these places are on there. There are so many places, and there are so many, you know, standing stones or caves with carvings in them, or rocky outcrops with a church on them.
Or huge mounds or temples made by different cultures that all seem to have the same construction technique.
and they've all been put them in the same place, in the same direction. What's intriguing about it is that on May Day, but we've got to take into account the fact that the calendar changed and there's a few days difference, but approximately May Day, the sunrise is in the east at one end of the ley line and goes all the way across. And so again, you're looking at, well, maybe there's some other factor involved. I mean, there is one theory that ley lines were really the maps of the ancients when people were wanting to get from one place to another. They didn't have a map. They didn't have compasses. The easiest way was to go, aim for that hill over there. When you get to that hill, aim for the next hill. And intriguingly, this St. Mary sent Michael one. Back in the day when England, the United Kingdom, was still attached by a land bridge to Europe, this was the point you would have come into Europe. You'd have come from Europe into England. And if you'd followed the route of the ley line, it would have taken you right down to the southwest.
Wow.
Where the tin mines were. And the tin was the magical alloy of metal of those days, because you mixed it with copper. And then you got bronze, which is a far more, it was a weapon of mass destruction in its time.
Yeah, I mean, it was far more steeled in its use. Copper is very, very malleable, and it's very hard to make any kind of sharpenable instrument out of copper.
Yeah.
But once you add tin to it, it hardens it and makes it sharpenable. So, it was.
You're just looking, is it a coincidence that this ley line leads you right across the country to where the tin is found? Were places built for that very reason? This is on the route, and of course, once you have a route, then towns start cropping up, and bars start cropping up, and places where people can rest start cropping up, and people would celebrate, come back with their tin. We've got our tin; it's great. Let's go to Stonehenge and have a party. And thank our gods for what's been happening. So, say it is an intriguing thing, and again, it's one of these things that, there's an element of truth lying at the beginning, lying at the heart of this, what otherwise seems a fanciful idea.
And I mean, it really is the concept of, hey, if you start putting enough lines crossing over each other, you're going to find a pattern. But there's something to this that is not that random. Like you're saying, there's way too many, because even with random coincidence happening, there would not be that many overlaps. There would not be that many coincidences, so to speak, happening. That circumstantial may pop up every once in a while, but it would be hard pressed to see it in a great majority. And it's almost the fact of when the line stops at one monument, you could almost just follow it out and find another one. You could almost just use it as a means by which to do archaeological search. It's that accurate. This has been a fascinating conversation, can I just say.
I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
Same. And you remind me a lot of one of the guests that I love having on this show, Graham Phillips. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to have a conversation with him. But he has a great book, The Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge, that is fantastic, that really goes into a lot of the original uses of the ancient stone circles all across Europe. Really fascinating research. He's fantastic. He's supposed to be coming on to talk about his work on the search for the Staff of Moses coming up here in the new year. So Very much looking forward to that conversation as well.
That sounds excellent. That sounds excellent.
Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, just going back to Stonehenge again, they're still doing a lot of archaeology on there and now reassessing it with more modern techniques. And one of the things they found was lots of bones of livestock, and they've been able to test them. I think you do it with the teeth and you can work out whereabouts the animals originally came from, because the water or the food they eat picks up certain trace elements, which you can analyze. And they found that these cattle, pigs and cows had been slaughtered and clearly eaten, had been brought from all over the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
So again, people were heading towards Stonehenge.
Yep.
Bringing their picnics with them, presumably for big festive, well, festivals, parties, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, probably Keith Richards was playing there. Yeah.
Well,
so old.
Well, and not just that, but to build something on that scale requires people to live locally.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, what are you going to do? Trek 2-3 miles across the way, across the hinge, so to speak, to go to work, to build the hinge? Like, it makes much more sense to have towns directly there around it. And they're really starting to show some very, very interesting work with remains that are found in high priest burials, similar things. It's very interesting to see that the similarities all across the region, even across the water where there are stone circles. So it's fantastic to have people like you on to concur with that kind of research to say that, like, yes, that is actively what's happening.
I mean, you know, the point you were making about there being a village there or a town there, you know, the Egyptian pyramids.
Yeah.
The view you see in the old movies was it was lots of slaves being forced to do it. But again, excavations have revealed that there were villages there where the craftsmen lived, you know, and same thing. You didn't whip your slaves to death. You needed them alive to do the job, and you had them there, and they were fed, they were accommodated.
Yeah, they were fed, they were rationed. They got bread and beer every day.
Exactly.
That was part of their rations.
Yeah, and they built pyramids.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that we often forget when we're dealing with ancient civilizations. Is that we are judging them by our standards.
Yes.
And because we don't know how they did something, doesn't mean it was the aliens that did it. It just means that we've lost the techniques that they had.
Well, we may have literally just been overthinking it. Like, we had a guest, Stephen Myers. I've listened to him on Coast to Coast, all kinds of programs for years. He's the head of the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation. And his whole theory is that they basically diked off the River Nile because that's where they were bringing the stone down to build the pyramids with anyway. And they just diverted the water and flooded the plain. Basically just keep building the retaining wall up and up and up. And you just float everything into place, release the water, and drop it. Flood it again, wash, rinse, repeat. And you build the pyramid. And it explains why there are no gaps between the stones, why it looks like they were dropped in one piece. Like so many, it explains the crazy amount of water erosion that's there.
That
otherwise would have had to been an extra 10,000 years of rain yeah. and hard, heavy rain. So it explains so many things that are there that regular Egyptology is just like, nope. But yet still they can't answer the question.
Exactly. And I say it's that thing that just because we sitting here in the 21st century can't understand how they did it doesn't mean it was aliens. It just means that we can't understand how they did it.
Yeah.
And
or that we're just too pig-headed to agree on the fact that they did it this way.
Yeah.
Because we literally do have, at this point, the religion of history. We have the religion of science. And and the fact of it is anathema to say otherwise. You may as well, look at people like Richard C. Hoagland, who was a NASA researcher. He helped write the message that went out on the Pioneer spacecraft, man. And when he came out and started telling his theories about the complex on Cydonia and the 19.5 degrees between everything and the correlation between temples here on Earth and stuff like that, you don't hear much from Richard C. Hoagland anymore.
No.
You know?
That is sadly an aspect of science, particularly when you start heading into what we'll roughly call paranormal to cover everything, is that it's career suicide for an academic to come out with such theories. They'd be ridiculed. Well, and I say the whole of the field of Earth mysteries, which ley lines fall into, again, that's just poo-pooed.
Yep.
But there's something there.
There's something there. Otherwise, how does water witching work? Explain it to me. Explain it to me how the same guy can go find precious metals. Explain that to me. I would love to know how some strange dude can come up, cut a bough off a tree, and find water on my property.
Yeah.
Dependably, with a 90% success rate, better than a paid surveyor. If you find a good water witch, he will find water faster than a geo surveyor will find it for you, and you will get it at half the cost.
Well, I mean, some of the surveyors in the UK, they take dousing rods with them. Because they don't know why, but it works.
It works.
And
if it's a way to possibly confirm it in the field and start a process without having to wait the 2 weeks for all the data to come back.
Yeah.
You know? It's interesting to see that, like you're saying, these concepts are poo-pooed by science. They're thrown aside, they're cast aside, and it's one of those, hey, you know, what if the Earth is this? What if the Earth is not the center?
Hmm.
Just throwing it out there. What if it's not?
Exactly.
We have to be willing to look at that. We have to be willing to question. The day I stop questioning, I will probably be stone dead in my grave, and people will be taking their measures that I don't come back. Just to bring this conversation full circle.
Yes, indeed. I'll be there chopping your legs off.
That's right. I want no less than you, Charles. You at least know how to historically do it properly.
Exactly.
With that in mind, once again, thank you so much for coming on the show. I cannot wait to have you on again and again and again to talk about folklore and history and lost history, all that good stuff. Yeah. I would love to do an episode with you on alchemy and witchcraft. Because I've been wanting to do it, especially on alchemy. I've been wanting to do one on that for a while. And it seems like you may be the guy.
I probably should be the guy, and I certainly will be a better place. Give me a couple of months into writing my book when I've got all my stuff drawn together.
But, absolutely. I mean,
it's a fascinating topic. And, little things like Isaac Newton wrote more about alchemy than he did in his straightforward science that everybody remembers him for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are quite a few. John Dee. Ooh, that's an episode in and of itself. That could be like a day-long conversation. The works of John Dee. Man, I love his work. He is amazing. So, once again, thank you so much for coming on. Tell everybody where they can go to find Weird Tales, listen to more of this stuff, where they can go to find your work with Ancient Origins, where they can go to get your books, other than the Dudes and Beer Store, of course.
Yeah, well, as you say, the Dudes and Beer Store. My website, which has everything on it, including my shows and links to my Ancient Origins articles, but you can find Ancient Origins on the website, on the internet anyway, but is urbanfantasist.com, and that has everything on there. And you can find me on Twitter on Urban Fantasist as well. And if it's weird, if it's slightly out there, I'll be there talking about it, but possibly with a little bit of a sense of humor in there.
Oh yeah, same here. And that's just it. Like, you've got to have a twisted sense of humor with this stuff. Otherwise, it can get dark and dour quick, man.
Yeah.
It really can. Like, especially once you start looking at things through the lens of history, and once you start just remembering that adage of, my God, history repeats itself. And we are straight up against some of that dark age thinking right now.
Yes, there's another phrase, isn't there? The lesson of history is that nobody learns the lessons of history.
Yeah,
so we just
sadly
endlessly repeat them.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That didn't work well, did it?
Yeah, how'd that work out for you? Well, thank you once again for coming on. Our airwaves are always yours. You're more than welcome anytime. You may hear from me someday just randomly, like, hey, saw this in the news. You want to do an episode on it? So
yeah, I'm up for that.
Get ready. It has been an utter pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you're online checking out all the great work of Charles Christian, make sure to, of course, go on by the Dudes and Beer podcast. That is where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can find the Knowledge Vault, chock full of great stuff. Declassified government documents, all kinds of things. I'm going to have to find a PDF of the Malleus Maleficarum and add it in there. I know I have a couple. I won't be adding things like the Key of Solomon. Sorry, folks, that's just not happening. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other. If you can't be good, be good at it. Bye-bye, everybody.
Listen to our audio streams or chat with us live. Download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.